This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to Star Diary, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings, listeners, and welcome to Star Diary, a weekly guide to the best things to see in the Northern Hemisphere's night sky. In this episode, we'll be covering the coming week from the 13th to the 19th of June. I'm Ezzie Pearson, the magazine's news editor, and I'm joined on the podcast today by reviews editor Paul Money. Hello, Paul.
Hello there, Ezzie. We can have another look at what's going on in the night sky. There's always something, isn't there?
Absolutely. And so what is that something this week?
Well, we'll ignore the morning sky to a certain extent because we've still got the same old groupings of planets. We've got Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, we've got Venus, we've got Neptune, and even Vesta, the minor planet as well. So they're still there. So if you really like the morning sky, you can go and have a look at them if you want.
We have covered them a lot in the podcast, so you can always go back to previous episodes, or you can always go to the website www.skyatnightmagazine.com, where we have many guides on how to see the planets if that is your thing and you are interested.
Exactly. And there is loads there to entertain you for hours. So it certainly does me. So June the 13th to the 14th, we're talking about getting closer to full moon. Now, on the 13th, we mentioned last week, the end of last week, sort of on the 12th, Scorpius. And we actually had the moon quite close to Graphius and Dishuba with Antares to their left. Well, the next morning, or next evening, I should say, 11 o'clock again. Keep looking about 11 o'clock because the sky's a bit darker, so it's a bit better than earlier. You have the moon the other side of Antares this time. And this is the one where people will probably notice there's a bright star to the right of the moon. What's that star? And you'll say, ah, that's Antares. That's on the 13th. And the moon will look nearly full. And it's a bit of an illusion because to the naked eye, sometimes a day or so either side of full, it can still look full to the naked
Absolutely.
Eye. You need a telescope to really... binoculars might give you a better hint sort of thing, but a telescope will clearly show you that it isn't quite full as such. So, yes, so on the 13th, it's to the left of Antares, which is the heart of Scorpius. Full moon technically occurs later that morning, about 11:30 the next morning. So it's quite close to full moon, so it will look almost full. But as it happens, that fourth, you know, when we're actually on the 14th, when it is full moon itself, we will actually see the full moon the next night on the 14th, that evening. So when it rises, and by then it's actually moved into Sagittarius, which is one of those things. Now, the full moon is, as we've mentioned in past weeks, is pretty poor for crater relief because the light is straight down onto the surface. So you don't get the sharp shadows cast by the moon, or the sunlight shining on the moon at an angle. But it does give you the chance to see the rays, as we mentioned before, these wonderful rays, Chris, and there's loads of them again. There's lots of guides actually on our website to actually tell you how to find those rays and have a look at them. When you look at the seas you mentioned sort of thing, you can actually see them. But the thing about this is lots of them, and the prominent ones I always think are the Tycho, Copernicus, Kepler and Aristarchus. So well worth having a look at them, but there are others as well. But the 14th, the full moon on the 14th is also classed as a strawberry full moon. Now, The names of the moons is a bit of an oddity sort of thing. It's sort of like a more modern, recent thing that we started taking on a lot of these names. A lot of them are from the Americas.
Yes.
I think even some of them are actually associated with the American Indian sort of thing. The sort of names
with the First Nation peoples of America, yeah.
Exactly. So, so this is a strawberry full moon. So it won't look the colour of strawberry, although if you watch it when it's first rising, you've got the same effect that affects the sun when the sun's setting or rising and it's very red. You've got the atmospheric refraction taking place. So the moon can look reddish when it first rises. And again, if you've got a clear horizon and you can know, you can work out where the moon actually rises using planetarium software, you can watch for it. And it's quite an impressive thing to see it gradually change colour as it rises higher and goes from this sort of like strawberry old colour to a sort of like an orangey colour and then to a pale yellow and then eventually back to a silvery moon. Oh dear, I'm going to sort of start seeing like Doris Day by the light of the silvery moon now. That shows my age, doesn't it, sort of thing. Yes, I remember that film. So it's also not just a full moon and this strawberry full moon. It's also occurring at perigee. In fact, perigee is only about just under 12 hours away from the point of full moon. So we call it, technically they're called perigee full moons. Or stitch, I can never pronounce stitchy. I'm not even going to try. They're incredibly complex. But the common name now has become into parlance. This is the idea of the super moon. It was done by an astrologer, Richard Knoll, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a bane between astronomers. The real diehards are, oh, you can't call it a super moon. But if it gets the public looking at the moon, you know, it's the popularization. That's what it is. So, yes, it's not an official title, but it will be a supermoon. And perigee is so close. It's even closer next month. So we can cover that next month as well. So
I think the term that you were scrabbling for earlier is perigee syzygy.
Syzygy. Think of scissors. They are. Now I know how to do it. Scissors.
I definitely think that Supermoon is a much more snappy title, and that's probably why it's a bit more popular with the public. But yes, it's I always think it's good to any excuse to look up at the moon because it's just so accessible. You can always see it. Like you always said, if you can't see the moon, it's probably not a good day to be doing astronomy anyway. But as long as it's, you know, even vaguely clear, you'll be able to see the moon. And it's always a great opportunity to get out there and persuade people to start taking up the hobby, even if it's just, you know, looking up at the night sky occasionally.
Exactly. I mean, that's what we're all about, is promoting the subject, getting more people into it. And, you know, if we can popularise certain things. And I think we should take over the term supermoon from the astrologer. We should own it. We should take over it. You know, because, you know, as I say, it does get the public looking out. I do get people asking me about the supermoon and what it is. And so I do explain. But the fact that they're approaching me means they're approaching an astronomer to actually talk about it. And I'm sure you get the same as well. But it is interesting. I mean, I think it gets a bit overblown about the size of the moon. One of the sad things about the media is they often blow it out of proportion and say, oh, it's a super big moon this particular night. Well, the reality is, if you can remember the size of the moon the previous month, then you're doing extremely well and you can visually compare them. Photography-wise, you can do, of course. I mean, that's what amateurs do.
I have seen some really brilliant photographs where they do composites showing the various full moons, and they've all been adjusted so that they're the same size, and you can see them getting bigger and smaller, and I think those are really good. So if you're an astrophotography person and fancy doing something a little bit different, maybe there's an idea for you.
There's a project, isn't it, sort of thing. Absolutely. You show the size of the moon. And it also, the thing that people forget is that, you know, the perigee is coinciding with full moon this particular time and will do in July as well. So it's even closer in July. But the thing is, perigee, it does drift apart. So perigee can occur when it's first quarter and it occur also when it's last quarter. So not obviously in the same, you know, time frame, but, you know, give it a few months and it'll be occurring when it's, say, last quarter. And so you could actually do the same project with the last quarter or the first quarter moon. In fact, with any time moon, you can work out when it occurs at perigee and then make a point of photographing it at perigee, regardless of what the phase is, and then building up this wonderful project, this picture showing its size difference. But visually, it's very difficult to see the size difference, but photographically, it shows up extremely well. So there, that's I mean, there's loads of projects you can do. And again, you don't need necessarily to have, you know, really dark skies for this. This is the, you know, we're getting into the summer skies, aren't we? We aren't quite technically in summer, but it's light enough. I mean, there's so meteorologically from the 1st of June, it's summer. So there we are. So, you know, I always scream at the TV weatherman saying, no, no, wait until the 21st or the 22nd of June when we get the summer solstice. But no, I can sort of understand their idea. Anyway, we actually find that the moon, of course, has been moving through Sagittarius then. And then we find on the 18th and 19th, we have a bit of a surprise, because what's happening is that the planets do slowly, as the year progresses, rise earlier and earlier in the night. So by the time we get to the 18th and 19th, we're actually finding Saturn is rising around about midnight. Which sort of, I always get excited about that sort of thing, because I know that means it's not going to be long before Saturn is in the evening sky. And of course, usually when you get in Saturn rising sort of thing, when the sun sets, that's opposition. So that's the time to really get excited. But I like the idea that once it gets rising around about midnight, you know it's not going to be long before it's rising in the evening sky. So it's easier to actually observe. And although it's 2 a.m. in the morning on the 18th, we have the moon either side of Saturn, and we often describe it either side of a planet. But this is now back into the morning sky. But as I say, Saturn will rise around about midnight-ish. Now, the moon, its orbit is below the ecliptic at the moment. So, of course, the moon is lower, so you'll have to wait a bit longer for the moon to actually rise. But it is now waning towards noon, so the phase is decreasing in size. Saturn forms a shallow triangle with Delta and Gamma Capricorni in the early mornings of the 18th and 19th. And on the 18th, the waning moon joins them. Now, on the 18th, it lies just above Zeta Capricorni. Above. Now, again, it's not an exciting star, but it is close. And if you use binoculars, you will not mistake it. You will see there is a star below the moon, and this is Zeta Capricorni. And so you've got this grouping on the 18th sort of thing, with the moon with Zeta, and then you've got Delta and Gamma Capricorni, and then Saturn. And of course, if you put a telescope on Saturn, you'll be amazed at the rings. I mean, a lot of people's first views, surely. I always think it should be mandatory. The first view through a telescope should be at Saturn, because it just blows you away. I mean, yeah, seeing the rings, you know. I had an eight or nine-year-old at a public event I ran some years ago, whereby Saturn was very low and it was rising, but the telescope was almost horizontal. So you can see it's just above the horizon. But there was Saturn. So he looked through the telescope, looked at Saturn, and then cheekily turned around and says, oh, it's a slide at the end of the telescope. So I said, take another look. And he looked through the eyepiece and went, and I banged the telescope. Well, of course, the view wobbled. Now, if it was a slide, it wouldn't do that, so it would stay fixed. But it wobbled all over the place. And oh, cool! In them days, it was cool. But he was just absolutely blown away, the fact that you could see the rings. Because, you know, you think, oh, it's something you can see only in a telescope and photographs. But visually seeing it for himself, it just blew him away.
It's definitely that one. The other one for me was the first time I saw the moons of Jupiter. And the first time I saw all four Galilean moons of Jupiter, that kind of idea that we can see not just planets, but the moons going around them, just kind of like, because I am fully aware of just how far away those things are. So it's kind of like, it blew my mind a little bit.
And you're following the footsteps of Galileo. I mean, exactly. You know, I mean, and to me, that's it's the link we sometimes have with the past when we, following the footsteps. I mean, because Galileo looked at Saturn and he saw it's described as appendages. He didn't say ears. He said appendages sort of thing, you know, to Saturn. So we've always assumed they meant ears as such. But
they definitely look like ears.
Oh,
like
yeah.
if you haven't got a good enough telescope to fully sort of resolve the rings, they look like ears.
They're blobs either side, aren't they?
Depending on what time of year you'll watch or time of the cycle, because the rings of Saturn do tilt up and down. So sometimes it's just a line, and at other times you can sort of see it quite a good angle to it. So it does actually depend, you know, how eerie they look.
Which was another proof that planets were inclined like the Earth is inclined, that Saturn has a tilt very similar to the Earth, a little bit higher. I think it's about 29 degrees, if I remember, of Saturn. So we get quite a grandstand view of the rings. But as I say, I've seen the ring plane crossings, and it's really, really eerie to look at Saturn and go, where's the rings? Who's nicked the rings? Because they were so thin. They're only the best amateur astronomers with the best instruments were able to see that thin line of the rings. That was quite something. Damien Peach is one of them. Absolutely amazing that he took a picture like that. But
definitely,
of course,
look up those pictures if you can.
Yes, definitely. They're absolutely amazing what he did. He did an entire cycle through the full season, a year of Saturn, which is, again, 29 years for Saturn. It's the orbital path around the sun. So that was quite an achievement, I have to say. I mean, I'm not good at telescope, not a good enough planetary imager to really do that. But, you know, I try my best. But that was on the 18th. And on the 19th, the moon is the other side. So I always love it when it swaps sides sort of thing, you know. But then Saturn is to the upper right of the actual moon itself. So, you know, again, it shows the clockwork motion that we mentioned about the moon going past the planets. But that's in the morning sky. And, of course, if you really want to leave it, to give it another hour, and Jupiter, Mars, Neptune and Vesta. And eventually, just before the real bright, always be careful. Don't observe when the sun's rising. Just be very careful about that.
Always
be careful. But you should catch, actually, Venus as well. So there's plenty going on, but I just thought it's nice that technically Saturn is getting close to rising in the evening sky. We're getting close to that. So, but to get it best, it's best to let it higher in the sky. So it's over in the southeast at 2 a.m. in the morning. So well worth having a look at that. And we mustn't forget, you know, this is the season for the noctilucent clouds, these night shining clouds. So again, keep a lookout roughly from the northeast to the northwest, just in case sort of thing. It's over in the northwest in the evening and drifts through north and then appears in the north east in the morning sky. But to have a look, you never know. You might see him. You know, it's close. We should get. I want to hope that we have a good display. Some years are good, some years are bad. You know, we've had some really good displays. The year of Neowise, remember Comet Neowise? That was really good. And I mean, I didn't have a good horizon to get the noctilucent clouds and Neowise, which was a great shame. So I was quite jealous of all the fantastic pictures. But that was quite something to get the shimmering bluey silver view of the noctilucent clouds and this comet hung in them as well. But keep a lookout. We won't have a comet, but we will have hopefully some displays. Keep a lookout towards the north. And there you are, is it? That's another week done.
Thank you very much for telling us all about that, Paul.
It's a pleasure, and see you for next week.
If you want to find out even more spectacular sights that will be gracing the night sky throughout the month, be sure to pick up a copy of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we have a 16-page pull-out sky guide with a full overview of everything worth looking up for. Whether you like to look at the moon, the planets, or the deep sky, whether you use binoculars, telescopes, or neither, our sky guide has got you covered, with the detailed star charts to help you track your way across the night sky. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Star Diary podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.